Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Tulsa Opera presents its final production of the season this weekend when the Tulsa Youth Opera take to the stage to present composer Dean Bury's The Hobbit, based on the works of J.R.R. Tolkien. The Youth Opera is the training program for young singers at Tulsa Opera, grades 3 through 12, and in the production will portray nearly all the roles from Bilbo Baggins to a band of dwarfs and more, along with one adult singer who will portray Gandalf the Grey and the voice of the dragon, Smaug. For this imaginative tale, Tulsa Opera needed an imaginative director, Alison Moritz, who's making her Tulsa Opera debut. Her productions have been noted for her imaginative direction, and the young director recently won Opera America's Director Designer Showcase for her team's concept proposal for The Cradle Will Rock by Mark Blitzstein. Her current season includes directing productions of The Magic Flute for Opera Memphis and the Orlando Philharmonic. She's assistant director at Seattle Opera, Opera Theater of St. Louis, and Central City Opera, and guest taught at the University of Maryland's Maryland Opera Studio. Her future projects include new productions here in Tulsa, along with Austin Opera and the Orlando Philharmonic. She served as a resident assistant director at both the Minnesota Opera and the Atlanta Opera, and she was also interim faculty at the Eastman School of Music in Rochester. Tulsa Opera presents The Hobbit this Saturday at 2:30 and 7:30 and Sunday at 2:30 at the Williams Theater of the Tulsa Performing Arts Center. Alison Moritz is my guest today. Alison Moritz, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You're directing this youth opera production of The Hobbit. Take us to the first step. How do you create Middle Earth on a small stage when we think of Middle Earth as being this super large place?
I think what set designer William Bowles and I set out to do was really recreate the experience that you have when you're reading the book rather than try to recreate something of the scope of the Peter Jackson film adaptations. So we've taken a very theatrical approach, and it is a world very evocative of texture and wood and vellum, paper, all of that sort of cozy feeling of Bilbo's hobbit hole, and also the vastness of the forests of Middle-earth. So we use a set limited vocabulary of wood and canvas to create in many different configurations the enormous array of scene changes that are required from the novel, because it's truly an epic journey.
Now, does the opera also reflect those sort of scene changes as well? I know because it was created for Toronto, Canadian Children's Opera Group, and sounds like they had a huge budget for the very first.
They did, and also the Sarasota Opera production is quite large. And one of the things that I thought when we initially approached it was I wanted to have the sense that we were constantly shifting scenes without feeling like we had to push pause on the action between each scene. So the goal is to get more of a cinematic crossfade from one location to the next without feeling like, you know, the curtain has to come in, we all pause and wait 5 minutes while a tree gets put on stage. So it is a lot of different locations, and it's taken some theatrical ingenuity and also a decent amount of magic to create all of the locations of Middle Earth, but I think to a good effect.
Can you give us at least a peek at some piece of theatrical ingenuity to make something happen like that?
Sure. There are all of these moments in the book where Tolkien sort of pans out and will have a moment of narration that describes a long portion of the journey, like a journey of miles rather than steps. And so for those kinds of moments, we actually are using shadow play. So the backdrop of the set is a large painted map of the Misty Mountains and the Lonely Mountains. And we have small figures that are made of, you know, paper and wire. It's a very old-fashioned kind of stage magic. And we have this puppetry of characters like the dwarves and Bilbo and Gandalf actually going on a journey up and down the Misty Mountains. So we have this sort of ability to scale from the larger story of the journey to on stage with the singers, the smaller, more emotional parts of the journey.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like that sounds like really old techniques. I mean, Victorian sort of thing.
Totally. And similarly, the way we create the dragon on stage is our whole goal is to expose sort of the bones of the theatrical magic the same way. When you're reading the book, your brain has to take that leap between the text and the way you imagine it to be. we want the audience to still feel like such a part of the action that they're filling that gap. So the goal for us has been to not necessarily spell out everything, but give you enough to feel like you're still there and an essential part of the action. And that has turned out to a very charming effect, especially because it gives the kids who are involved so much extra to do. We have, I would say, 3 or 4 different kinds of puppets, including the shadow play and including an 8-foot-tall dragon puppet. And it's really fun to get to see the kids interacting with all of these different stage techniques. I think it's an equal part of their growth experience. They're not only learning a ton about how to prepare music and work with each other as a team, they're also learning all of these different techniques and practices of the ways that we create theatrical magic.
That is really cool. For those who are not familiar with this particular version of the Hobbit story, what has Dean Bury done? We think of, you know, the Hobbit as being this sort of epic journey, not necessarily conducive to being an opera. What has he done to create the magic of the Hobbit in an operatic form?
Well, one of the things that he's done, and quite smartly, is to focus on Bilbo's emotional journey from, you know, a sort of scared homebody to someone who is brought along on this quest and ends up being braver and more than he ever thought he could be. And so the way that that's revealed musically is through repeated motifs that are used in different orchestrations and in different contexts and with slight changes to the text as Bilbo gets braver and braver and braver. And then similarly, there's a moment where we repeat the same theme as the dwarves continue their journey through different parts of Middle Earth. So we get this sense of both the familiar and familiar characters in different contexts as we move through the plot. And I think, to me, my favorite musical device that he's used is there is one adult in the cast, baritone Andrew Wandigman, and he plays both Gandalf and the voice of the dragon Smaug. So musically, it's very satisfying to have this concept because, in a way, Gandalf is the voice of encouragement and reason for Bilbo, and Smaug sort of tempts him with not only riches, but also he creates this doubt in Bilbo's mind of whether the dwarves are truly his friends. And it's very effective to have the same vocal part playing both the good angel on Bilbo's shoulder and the bad.
Yeah, no, that really is very good. So you mentioned there's one adult in the cast, the baritone who's doing the role of Gandalf and the voice of Smaug. But the rest are kids from the area, right?
I think the youngest is 8 and the oldest has just graduated from high school and will be entering as a freshman in the fall at Oklahoma City University, I think. So we have about a 10-year age range, and there are about 40 kids in the cast, and they're all active the entire time. They play all of the various characters that you know and love from Middle Earth. So there are thrushes, there are wargs, there are goblins, and, you know, I have to say some of the littlest goblins are my favorites because it's just so satisfying to see them with their battle axes at the ready. So it's pretty delightful.
Now, in the rehearsal process, what's it like to work on a piece like this with a full cast of kids?
You know, the director of Tulsa Youth Opera, Aaron Beck, has done such a wonderful job training them both musically and some of them are really old professionals and very quite experienced hands at this because they've sung in the chorus of main stage Tulsa Opera productions for so long. So it's really nice to see the older kids sort of taking some responsibility.
Leading by example,
exactly.
That sort of thing. Do you have to adapt your production schedule because they're kids, or do you just say, here's the production schedule, get in there and do it?
Yeah, this is an interesting change, I think. It is my first time working not only for Tulsa Youth Opera, but for Tulsa Opera. And I believe that in the past, when the Youth Opera was not part of this amazing summer stage series, they rehearsed at a slightly slower pace, you know, once or twice a week over the course of many months. But in this instance, they're trying a new model where it's really an immersive experience for 3 weeks, and it's very akin to how fast a traditional opera production works, which I have to say is an amazing experience for these kids. That said, we're very cognizant of, you know, their growing abilities in terms of focus and stamina. So we have usually a few days a week where we rehearse 3 hours for two sessions, and then a few other days a week we rehearse in 1 4-hour session. So it's almost like opera camp in a way. You're immersed and totally focused for a few hours a day, but it's not all day.
And really a 3-week schedule, that's pretty much what a professional singer would, if they went to a medium-sized city to do opera, that's usually about a 3-week schedule, isn't it?
It absolutely is. This is a very, creating the schedule for this from my end was absolutely the same as if I were working on a main stage opera for another company. And similarly, our production values in creating a new production, this is not a quote-unquote kids show. So much care and attention has been put into creating a wonderful scenic environment. A Chicago set designer, William Bowles, is my collaborator in that endeavor. And a local Tulsa props master, Brian Johnson, has been doing amazing work creating some truly unique and inventive props.
I would think for a show like this, you'd have an incredible amount of props.
There are many props, and it's very, you know, because of all the battle scenes and the puppets and all of the, you know, treasure of the dragon, there's a lot at play, and it's very fun to see what he's able to build in his own little laboratory. I think my favorite so far is maybe the warg masks, which have light-up red eyes and are built out of this sort of caged exterior with pelts of fur. They look amazing. And I think you can see them actually on the Tulsa Opera Pinterest and Instagram accounts.
Yeah. Now, I would think that's the other thing with a piece like this. You're probably using extensive makeups and things like that to create all these various different orcs, wargs, everything in between.
Because the transitions are so fast, we're trying to do more with actual pieces and small costume pieces and the way their musical and physical approach differs. Because often a kid will run off stage as a goblin and emerge 2 seconds later as an elf. So rather than having elaborate costume changes that can really kind of slow down each transition, it's a little bit more about using what we have in many different configurations.
So you're using body movements and things like that to sort of convey different characters?
Yeah, and also we are having small costume changes, but definitely a less realistic approach and more of a theatrical approach to the makeup, because for me, it's a very wonderful thing to see the kids' own facial expressions and joy in performing, and I wouldn't want to cover that up with too much that occluded it. So it's to see a 13-year-old boy with a goblin axe really, really getting into it is pretty special. So, and to see the 9-year-old elf maidens, they are elf maidens already. We don't necessarily need to add more than a braided hair piece and a flower crown.
Yeah. So did you create these archetypes for the kids to demonstrate each character type? Like, you know, is there a goblin look? Is there an elf look? Is there a orc look?
Yeah, there are. There aren't orcs in this piece.
Oh, okay.
But the dwarves stay dwarves throughout. So it's very interesting to see also not only what the dwarves look like as a group, but the variation within the group of 13 dwarves. They definitely have a diverse spectrum of personality types, and it's fun to sort of tease out their own personalities and let that inform the staging. You know, yesterday I asked one kid to sort of give Bilbo a hug, and he was a little shy about it, and his partner that he always is paired with said, "I'll do it," and it turned into one of the most special moments of the show. So it's very fun to see the kids growing and changing over the course of this very rapid 3-week process.
My guest today is Allison Moritz, the stage director for Tulsa Opera and Tulsa Youth Opera's production of Dean Bury's The Hobbit, which takes place this Saturday and Sunday with 3 performances, 2 matinees, and a Saturday evening performance at the Williams Theater of the Tulsa Performing Arts Center. This is Allison's debut with the company. Hopefully we'll see you on a main stage down the road. And you're moving up very quickly in your stage directions as far as moving up with companies and doing a full main stage and very innovative productions in a lot of your work, doing a early piece in your career of doing a version of Salome with a man in the role of Salome, and he holds up John the Baptist's head on an iPad.
Well, that was a production for a Fringe Festival, and so when we were putting it together, we really kept wondering, what does fringe mean to us? So it might not be an approach that I would take if, you know, say Tulsa Opera asked for a production of Salome. But in this case, it really felt like we were really trying to explore, what does fringe mean to us, and how can we engage a portion of the public in the conversation of opera without feeling like we were alienating them. So we used all of the text and many of the musical motifs from the Strauss Salome, but then we added all of this other, John the Baptist actually sang Baptist hymns. We added all of these different musical vernaculars to weave throughout and had a new orchestration. So the text was delivered in equal part by the instrumentalists who were on stage playing the show and by actors. So it felt just like a really immersive environment, and it was a very high impact and quick 90-minute adaptation of Salome. Yeah.
Now, you recently did two different productions of The Magic Flute, one in Memphis and another in Orlando. The Memphis was a full stage version. The Orlando version was a sort of a concert version set in, a rock music hall.
Yeah, the venue that we used in Orlando is called the Plaza Live. And so on one night you might be hearing Ophira Eisenberg doing, Ask Me Another. On the next night you might be hearing a grunge rock band, and then you could come back the next week and I think it would be RuPaul's Drag Race on tour or Adam Carolla, a comedian. It's used for many, many event purposes, and it's very funny because you'll walk in and sometimes there'll be no seats at all because they had a grunge concert in there where everybody was, using the entire audience level as a mosh pit. So we did not use a mosh pit for Magic Flute, but we did have three sold-out performances.
Yeah, and it was very innovative. You had the orchestra sort of on the wings, and then you had this middle little section with a little screen, and you use all sorts of innovative techniques to get across this magical story and really just using old-fashioned stage magic from what it looks like.
Yeah, for us, this Magic Flute, I was collaborating with conductor and music director Eric Jacobson, and it was his inaugural production at the Orlando Philharmonic. And so we really wanted to kind of showcase Eric and his approach to musicality in a unique way. So for me, it was a very big focus to have him actually on stage as almost playing the role of the conductor. And we created this overture where we actually built the entire stage on stage while the orchestra played
the famous overture. Yeah, wow.
And it was very exciting because when things began, people really didn't know what to think about, has it really begun? And for me, the idea is that I grew up with opera, and I discovered opera at the same time as I discovered the Beatles and all of these other cultural touchstones. So there's really no high or low, like high or low culture. It should all be not just accessible, because it should all be tangible and real. And so we were really looking at an approach where, how can we make it feel like this is the world premiere of the Magic Flute and that audiences don't exactly know what to expect at every turn? Because the Magic Flute is a perennial favorite, and we knew that because of our time limitations and the concert format, we were never going to be able to scratch every itch of a traditional production. Mm-hmm. So we thought we might as well have a little bit of fun with it.
Yeah. That's one thing I look at your resume. A lot of the productions you work on is sort of reimagining the piece. I know you did a Handel Orlando set in the Victorian era. Is that sort of your view of opera, of sort of merging this high and low art as opposed to maybe just the traditional stage productions? Or are you interested in doing those too?
Well, I think part of it, to be quite frank, has to do with where I am in my own career and what companies are interested in engaging me. And also, a lot of times, more traditional productions are either remounts or rental sets, and sometimes those are attached to particular directors already. And so that's just sort of the nature of how one begins a career in opera. Mm-hmm. For my part, I'm absolutely interested in beautiful and engaging traditional productions, because, for example, one of my favorite operas is Puccini's Fanciulla del West, and I see no reason why that needs to be set
anywhere than the Old West.
Yeah. So a very beautiful Fanciulla del West would be a dream to direct for me. But there are other operas, and I think Handel is a very good example of this, where because compositionally they were created in a different context, we have to find some way that the audience really feels like they have an in, that they understand the world.
There's a door to get,
and what's at
stake.
Yeah,
there's a door to get into the world that they were about to enter. Well, contrasting the Orlando Magic Flute, the Memphis Magic Flute was fairly traditional, although it sounds like it was a really old production that you really spruced up in an interesting way, because it looks so fresh.
That's fantastic to hear.
The stills from the production just look like it was a brand new production. And in fact, as you were telling me off air, that no, this production had been around forever.
Yeah, the production is, I think, almost as old as I am, frankly. But you know what? I have to give absolute credit where credit is due. Ned Canty, the general director of Opera Memphis, is basically, I consider him sort of the P.T. Barnum of opera. He really knows how to make opera into fantastic entertainment. And we had resources to spruce up the production. We created a few new costumes. We had fantastic local talent doing the lighting design. And it didn't hurt that we also had an excellent photographer for that production. So, plus, we had a truly world-class cast. And I think that's the same situation here at Tulsa Opera, is when I work in companies like this all over the Midwest, I realize often, and I'm also from St. Louis, I should say, often Midwestern audiences might not know actually how wonderful the talent is that's coming in specifically to create opera in your own communities. And it's just truly a gift for me to be able to travel and experience a city like Tulsa for the first time in this fairly creative way, and where I am collaborating with local artists. Everywhere I go when I'm working on a gig like this, I tell people I work for the opera, and it's fantastic to see their responses, because sometimes people say, I didn't even know we had an opera company. And other times, and this has definitely been the case in Tulsa, I find that the community is already really engaged. And there are so many people who are already very invested in the arts and cultural community in Tulsa. So that's been really a treat to experience firsthand.
Well, in The Hobbit, Dean Bury's music, Dean Bury is not really a tremendously well-familiar name for people unless you're really into the opera world. He's basically out of Canada for the most part. What can you tell us about his music? What's the sound of the music we're going to hear? Because it sounds, what I've heard, sounds really, really very tuneful, very engaging, and, you know, helps you slip into this world of Middle Earth.
It is very tuneful. I have to say, it's compositionally, I guess, how I would describe it is, this is almost like a Pixar movie, in the sense that if you went to see a Pixar movie as an adult, you would appreciate it and be entertained on a certain level, but you would also feel comfortable bringing the kids along. And that sort of dual audience where it's smart enough that adults can appreciate it, and also accessible and tuneful enough that kids will feel engaged from start to finish. That's really the sweet spot that Dean Bury is hitting with this composition. It's 90 minutes long. It's one act. There's a ton of action. There's a ton of melody. And I think really the whole family can enjoy it on both a musical and a theatrical level.
All right. Well, we wish you success with this production. And I should mention, you just received an award for a design for, I guess, is this actual a piece yet? Or is it the Opera America Award for The Cradle Will Rock? I assume this is the old Blitzstein piece?
It is. It absolutely is, which is a fantastic sort of opera. Blitzstein called it an opera for actors. So it's a short comedic satirical piece that was part of the Opera America's biennial director-designer competition. And what happens is every other year, Opera America creates a list of 10 titles and invites all of the directors and scenic designers and costume designers in the United States to submit designs for a potential production. And about a year ago, the team that I typically work with was named the winner of this competition.
Amazingly prescient, because the whole piece is about, you know, income inequality and the big guy squashing the little guys, which, you know, can't go anywhere today and hear something about that today.
Yeah, we were very inspired by how topical it felt, even though it was written in the 1930s. And for us, it felt like this is absolutely a story of operatic proportions, and that a lot of people are very invested in doing world premieres of operas, and rightfully so, because we want our genre to be a living, breathing genre and not full of museum pieces. But by that same token, there are so many corners of the repertoire that are underperformed and deserve to be seen and heard again.
Or were world premieres and never saw the light of day again.
Exactly. So that was one of the reasons that we decided to spend an entire year focusing on a design for this production, because we just really believed in its core message and in its relevance to today's society.
So you won this award. Does a production come out of it, or is it out there for an opera company to say, oh, maybe we should consider this? Is it speculative?
It is speculative. And I think that even more than eventually creating that production for an opera company is the fact that in the course of creating the designs over a year and working with Broadway designer Tobin Ost to hone them, he became our design mentor. Basically, it increased our skill set as a team so much that really I feel like any opera company could approach us to do, you know, another Magic Flute or a Traviata. And because we've gelled as a team in the exercise of creating this production, we would be able to do it. So I think the goal is less to create a very specific production and more to challenge the next generation of American directors and designers. So I was very excited and pleased to be recognized in that group of people, because, as I said, I've loved opera for a really long time. I saw my first opera over 20 years ago when I was 9 years old. So now you all know how old I am. But I saw my first opera when I was 9, and really it was a production of La Belle Helene at Opera Theater of St. Louis. And after I saw it, that was it for me. I was just hooked. So coming full circle and working with these kids day in and day out in the rehearsal room, it's very gratifying to see them feeling like they have not only investment, but also some ownership of what opera is and what opera can be. It's so inspiring to see, you know, 8-year-olds practicing sort of this really old art form and feeling like they're discovering it anew. So the joy of that as a lifelong opera lover is pretty tangible to me.
Well, let's hope you hook a few more this weekend with this production. Allison, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Stage director Allison Moritz will be directing Tulsa Opera's final production of the season, the Tulsa Youth Opera's production of composer Dean Bury's The Hobbit, based on the works of J.R.R. Tolkien. Performance dates are this Saturday and Sunday, Saturday at 2:30 and 7:30, Sunday afternoon at 2:30 at the Williams Theater of the Tulsa Performing Arts Center. For ticket information, visit tulsaopera.org. We're going to leave you with a little music from The Hobbit. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.